customs and practices that I'm going to go through tonight. One is holy water. Okay, and if you want to write these down, you can. The rosary. Scapulars. You might even know what some of these things are. Okay, which is fine. Scapulars. Statues and religious art. Incense and bells during Mass. Right, smells and bells, right? The exposition of the Blessed Sacrament and also benediction. When priests wear, especially Father and I wear for distributing Holy Communion, which is the black cassock, which is the black robe. Okay, what's its significance? Novenas, it's another thing. The date for Easter. How we come up with the date for Easter. All right. Relics. I've got a relic right here. First class relic of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. We talked about this, I think, in November. But the difference between a basilica and a cathedral. Okay, some of you may know, may not know. What's the difference between a priest, a monsignor, a bishop, a cardinal, all those different things where you hear all these words thrown around. Okay, what do those mean? Okay, now we can add to that list, but we'll start with that. And that might be enough to take us to the hour. If at any point you think that what your question is or something you'd like added is very much related to what I'm talking about, just raise your hand and yell it out. Okay? And if you really are shy, Joan over there has the magic question box, and you can go over to Joan and write your question. Not like I won't see who was writing the question, but then she'll bring it up to me. Okay, like a third-party mediator. Okay? Okay, so the first thing is holy water. You notice when you go into a Catholic church, there are these holy water fonts at the entrance. You may notice this, okay? And Catholics use their right hand. And remember, it's always your right hand. Now, why is that? Well, because, I'll just give you an example. The Italian word for left is sinistra. Sinister. Okay? La sinistra. That's Italian for left. Okay? So, there was a traditional belief way in the past, it's not dogmatic at all, but people thought, you know, you sit at the Father's right hand, you know, sit on my right, and the Psalms say, your foes I'll put beneath your feet. So the right hand was always the favorite hand. So, therefore, you know, so like, for example, you know, seminarians and priests joke about this, you know, let's say you're at dinner, and, you know, people are figuring out where to sit, and the bishop might say, sit at my right hand. Okay, and that means like a favorite position, right? But then if he says, sit on my left, okay, then he, okay, it means you're getting transferred. Okay, now, okay, it means you're on your way to the Dominican Republic. Okay, so, Haiti, here I come. All right, now, so, you take holy water in your right hand and you make a sign of the cross. Okay, now, what is that all about? Now, any of the veterans want to guess what that's about? What's it supposed to, why do we do that? Because you don't technically have to do that when you walk into church, but just Catholics are programmed to do it. Anyone want to venture a guess? Why? Helen Ann? It frightens the devil. Well, okay, it's a sacramental, right, which keeps the devil away. That's true. All right, but Tina? Martina? It helps prevent you from sin. Okay. Well, that may be true, but the symbolism is baptism. They're like little baptismal fonts. And it's a reminder that you walk into the church. I mean, you can think of it in these terms, right? The sanctuary represents heaven. The pews represent the earth. Okay? That's why we had communion rails, that there was a mark between heaven and earth. Right? And the priest comes from inside the sanctuary to distribute communion outside the sanctuary, right? He's bringing heaven to earth. Right? And then the baptismal font is a reminder when you walk into the church, right, that you are part of the mystical body of Christ. If you're walking into a holy place, this is a sanctified place, and you're coming in to do holy things, right? And the first and most essential sacrament for salvation is baptism, right? So that's where it all starts. It all starts with baptism. Everything else is just another way of actualizing your baptismal dignity. So that's the symbolism of holy water. Is this a question or a comment?
It's a question.
What's your question?
Is there any real point in doing it on the way out?
No. In fact, it's not appropriate to take holy water on your way out. Because you, you're coming into church. Now, if you do, okay, it's not like we stand out there going, oh my goodness, you know, like, whatever, you know. I'm just standing like, you know, like, please, you know. I don't look at you like, okay, you know, I'm one of those, okay. I don't know where they got their formation from. Okay, now, you can, okay, but it is a sacramental, and people do take holy water. For example, I always bless myself with holy water before I go to bed. I keep a bottle of holy water next to my bed. And I bless myself with holy water when I say my night prayers, right? So that I'll be protected from the devil. I mean, sacramentals like holy water or crucifixes, right? I mean, they are instruments, all right, for reminding us of grace, all right? And, you know, the need we have from protection from the evil one. And believe you me, you know, when I talk to soldiers who come back from deployments, you know, and they were on foot patrol, you know, and they were definitely in harm's way, you know, I mean, how many times did they grab onto their cross, you know, or make the sign of the cross before they go out there because they know this could be it. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, even making sign of the cross, a little holy water, I mean, just things like that. It's just sort of like, I mean, you guys ever watch, like, Hispanic baseball players when they step up to the plate? I mean, they got this whole thing going on, you know, and I mean, okay, a little bit of that superstition, I'm pretty sure, which we're not after that, okay, that's not what we're after here, okay, but, you know, or, you know, before they jump on the soccer field, you know, they make the sign of the cross and they tap the sideline, something like that, you know, and like Hispanics also they do the sign of the cross and the kiss, you know, that kind of thing. They make a little cross with their fingers, like this, and then they kiss the cross, that's what they're doing, okay. My favorite ones are my Mexican friends. When they come into church and they kneel down in the pew, it's three consecutive crosses, right? And I think to myself, no wonder you have to kneel for so long. You're exhausted. Okay, you know. All right. Now, genuflecting. Okay. Everyone knows what genuflect is. A good way to remember it: the French word for knee is genu, G-E-N-O-U, genuflect. Okay. In Roman times, you would always show deference to the emperor by dropping the right knee. Okay? Now, just a difference here. When you're meeting the Pope and you kiss his ring, you genuflect on your left knee. So that ever happens to you. So God gets the right knee. It's not that the Pope's sinister. Okay? Like, ooh, he gets the left knee. Like Judas. You know? Not like that. Okay. Alright, so you just show deference to God with the right knee. Okay, and we have other gestures, you know, bowing and, you know, sign of the cross, stuff and things like that. You might notice during the creed, when we say the words of the incarnation, and by the power of the Holy Spirit, he became man, right? We all bow, okay? Again, that's tied to genuflecting in front of the Eucharist. You never genuflect if the Eucharist is not there. So if it's just, if you're in a chapel without a tabernacle, you just bow to the altar. But if Jesus is there in the tabernacle, and the red light, the tabernacle light is on, that's your signal to genuflect. Okay? And that's an old Roman custom. Jimmy had a question?
Yes, I did.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
It's hard to break that habit of genuflecting when the tabernacle is empty.
It's true. It's hard to break the habit of genuflecting when sometimes you notice that the tabernacle might be empty. Let's say we move the Blessed Sacrament out. Or even better yet, how many of you Catholics have ever genuflected at the movie theater? I do it all the time. Because I'm just used to rows of seats. And I walk down an aisle. And before the, you know, screen, I've done that before. And people see me and they're like, oh, it's funny, Father genuflected. And wasn't even thinking. Okay? All right. You know you're Catholic when? Okay? Like Jack Foxworthy. You know you're Catholic when? Okay, go ahead.
The question is, the sign of the cross, is there a reason why you do it to the left shoulder, right shoulder?
No, the Orthodox do it the reverse. Roman Catholics do it left to right. Orthodox do it right to left. Now, there may be a reason for that, but I'm not sure. Okay? All right. Everyone good? That's good? Okay. The rosary. Who's got their rosary on them? Should always carry a rosary with you. This is my TSA-approved Homeland Security. No metal parts. This rosary always makes it through, no questions asked. This is my TSA-approved rosary. It's all yarn. Okay? I could choke someone with it, Wendy. You're right. Okay. Excuse me, sir, could you check his left pocket? I think he's got a choking device in there. It's blue. I think I saw him. Thanks a lot, Wendy. Note to self, never take her on pilgrimage. Okay, now, rosary. All right. Now, the rosary traditionally is believed to have been given by the Blessed Mother, St. Dominic, in the 13th century. We're not the only, by the way, religion that uses beads to pray. Muslims use beads to pray. The Jews have their own version of the beads. Okay? But this is not even a full rosary. Full rosary actually has 15 decades. Some even say now 20 decades, because there's 20 mysteries of the rosary. And a lot of non-Catholics get concerned about the rosary because they say, you know, Scripture says that you should not babble prayers like the pagans who think that they'll be heard by their many, you know, their many words, right, when you pray. Okay. Well, first of all, when you pray the rosary, you're not supposed to babble. Okay? And we do not believe as Catholics that simply because you say so many Hail Marys that somehow your prayer is going to be more heard more than one heartfelt Hail Mary by a person who's on death row. We make no claims that the more prayers you say, the better the quality of the prayer is, right? I mean, the reason that we have the Hail Mary said 53 times and a rosary is, one, you don't have to think of the words. When you know the Hail Mary, it's like a mantra, right, that you're sort of praying, sort of like the backdrop, but what you're really meditating upon is the mystery tied to the rosary. And then the Hail Mary, I mean, the word rosary is from the Latin rosarium, which means crown of roses. So the traditional belief is that as you pray each Hail Mary, you're putting a different flower in the crown that you're offering to the Blessed Mother, right, in veneration of her life and her powerful intercession in ours. Okay? Now remember, I said veneration, not adoration. We don't adore Mary like she's God. We venerate her as the greatest of all the saints. Big difference. All right. Questions about that, the rosary? You might also be familiar with things like the Divine Mercy Chaplet, which is also prayed on rosary beads as well. You can look that up, Divine Mercy Chaplet. If you'd like to come to a nice devotion, Sunday after Easter, second Sunday of Easter, Divine Mercy Sunday, 3 o'clock, we have the Divine Mercy devotions here. And that's all tied to a private revelation given in the earlier part of the 20th century to this Polish nun, St. Faustina, who was a contemporary of John Paul II in Poland. And the message that she was proclaiming, which of course is just a reiteration of what Christ has always proclaimed, was that, you know, his merciful heart was pierced for our offenses. And that people who go, even the most hardened of sinners, who goes with confidence to Christ, seeking his mercy, will be converted. Okay? And instead of saying the Hail Mary on each bead, we'd say, for the sake of his sorrowful passion, have mercy on us and on the whole world. For the sake of his sorrowful passion. It's a lot quicker to say. My grandmother was a champion rosary prayer. 13 minutes, somebody gets hurt. That is fast. Okay? I mean, typically 17 to 20 is a good pace. Okay? But she was world record holder. Okay? Now, you might wonder, how did she do that? As I was finishing my part of the Hail Mary, she was already halfway done with her new Hail Mary. Okay. And then she would always criticize me for being too slow. Say, come on. You know, like, I'm just, you know, I'm trying to just keep on just going. Just keep on going. Don't stop. You know. So she was like training for the marathon. Anyway, okay. Any question about the rosary? Yes, Kay.
I noticed
that people wear rosaries. Yeah. Yeah, rosaries are not meant to be worn. Yeah, they're not meant to be worn, but... Okay. I mean, it's not a fashion accessory. Okay. But, yeah. This is very true among my Hispanics. Okay. But I've given up trying to tell them not to wear it. Hang on a card. Yeah, that's okay. You know. I mean, as long as you pray it. You know. But I have a decorative one, and then I have the ring. Also, I don't recommend the rosary being prayed while you drive, like a regular rosary. Pray a ring rosary. Because if you play a regular rosary, you might pull the parking brake up. Speaking from experience. Okay, just a little safety tip from your priest. Okay, yes, Ron Cox.
Prayer beads versus rosary.
Prayer beads versus rosary.
They're about this long, and the soldiers want to carry them because they're not, you know, big and long.
You mean like prayer beads, like Mardi Gras beads?
No.
No.
No, it's, I have a set of prayer beads, and there's 10 beads on there.
And oh. Oh, yeah. Well, that's usually actually penitential rosary. The Irish used to use that when they were under persecution from the Brits, when the Catholic, when it was illegal to be Catholic, and it was so short that they could keep it in their pocket and work in the quarries or wherever they were confined and not be caught by the soldiers. And a lot of the soldiers let them go because it wasn't considered to be a choking device, like some of us suggested here tonight. Okay. All right. Good question. All right. Anyone else? Question about the rosary? All right. I mean, I just... Carlo, Phoebe. Yeah, okay. They come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. It's kind of a ring rosary type there. Yeah. That's about 29 cents on eBay. Right? You paid more. Okay. I'll show you how to bid better next time. Okay. Now, scapulars. Everyone know what a scapular is? Okay. How about the vets? Any of the vets wearing a scapular? All right, John Wagner, look at that. Okay, see that? Hold it up, John. There's your scapular. Okay, I'm holding one here, too. Okay, it's like two pieces of brown cloth. There are many different colors of scapulars, all related to different devotions. But the brown scapular is the most famous one. And this was given by Our Lady to St. Simon Stock. Okay, who's a British saint. And she promised that whoever dies wearing this scapular shall not suffer eternal fire. However, all other things being equal, like, you can't be like a mortally sinful person and then claim, I got my scapular on, woo, I'm in. Okay, you see what I'm saying? I mean, this presumes a life of devotion and piety. Now, I know some people who use this like, it's like a lucky charm. Okay, now I've got to tell you a funny story about this. Hold on for 1 second. Let me just untie this one. Well, John, actually come here for a second because you have yours ready to go. You got yours out? Okay. So I was in the seminary after exams in May. You know, you have to stand right here. You have to demonstrate. Okay. After exams on May, hold on for a second. Okay. Everyone give John a hand.
Yay!
Okay. Now, I was on vacation with some seminarians and then some potential recruits. And some of these guys, you know, are thinking about becoming seminarians, et cetera, et cetera. So we're out there, we have these benefactors who lend us their homes in Duck, North Carolina, the Outer Banks, and, you know, it's sort of like Beach Week, okay? But Duck is not like Myrtle Beach, okay? All right, it's not Daytona, okay? So, we're out there, I'm on the beach throwing the frisbee with another seminarian. He's not a seminarian, he never became one, but he was thinking about it, all right? And he was wearing a scapular, so put your scapular on outside your clothing. Now, he didn't have a shirt on, right? We're on the beach, right? And so we're throwing the frisbee around. And I overthrew him. So he goes running down the beach, and there's these two guys from UVA passing the lacrosse ball back and forth, okay? And, you know, they have their UVA shorts on, and one pant leg has UVA, the other end leg has a fraternity on, okay? So it's like frat daddies over there, okay? So frat daddy picks up the frisbee and is handing it back to my friend. And my friend says, thanks a lot, man. And the frat guy says, hey, dude, what's up with the tea bags? It's an evangelizing moment. And he says, it's a scapular. And he's like, all right. Give John a hand, everyone. Now, you might wonder what that is. Okay, that is a miniature of what nuns and monks wear as part of their religious habit, the religious garb. So you can picture a nun, right, with like the head, you know, the veil, and then she has that robe that she wears. Maybe she's Franciscan, it's brown. And then on the front, if you look closely, there's an apron that goes almost down to the floor, that covers her chest and then her back. Okay, and that is emblematic of the mantle of protection that her consecration to God brings. I mean, it's in and of itself has no power, obviously, right? But it's a reminder of her consecration to God and that she lives under the mantle of protection of the Blessed Mother. Okay, same thing with a monk. Okay, so that little thing that John's wearing, like this thing, is a miniature, okay, and it's just intended to be worn. One, to be a part of that order. Usually, you know, you get the benefit from the graces associated with the religious order that you're wearing it in honor of. So this is the Carmelite order, the the brown scapular, St. Simon Stock was a Carmelite monk, okay? But there are other colors of scapulars too, and you can look this up online. If you just put in scapular, and then just put in like color, you know, blue, brown, green, red, okay? And it'll give you a different religious order, different history behind each of them, but I don't want to spend all night on the scapular, okay? So just so that I tell you what those are. So if you see Catholics wearing that, now, remember, Catholics, do not leave these on your bedpost, because your bedpost cannot go to heaven. Okay, I know lots of Sealy posturpedics that are heaven-bound. Unfortunately, the person who sleeps in a Sealy posturpedic is not. No, I don't know. Okay, now I wear what's called a scapular medal, which is like a cross. Now, the reason I don't wear the scapular is because it gives me a rash. Because this is wool. Yeah. Okay? So, with my fragile constitution and delicate features, I prefer to wear 18 karat. Okay? So, alright, so that you can wear a scapular medal as a replacement. Okay? Okay. Any questions about that? Yes, Wendy.
Okay.
Who brought her along with me? Okay. Go ahead. I'm with you. I'm just teasing.
Isn't part of the purpose to be a little uncomfortable?
No. Is part of the purpose to be uncomfortable?
Like
a hair shirt?
Yeah.
No, if you're gonna do that, wear a hair shirt. So if I see you walking around with like hair sticking out, okay, that is just strange. Okay. Alright. No. I mean it could be. I mean maybe it is. But I mean, yeah. I don't know, maybe I'm supposed to have a rash. Yeah, you think so? Okay. Well, my doctor doesn't like it. Okay, so, good. All right, next thing, statues. Now this causes all kinds of interesting concerns among non-Catholics. Oh my goodness. You don't really believe that's Jesus, do you? No. I really don't believe that's Jesus, trust me. Okay, I believe something even more incredible, that he's actually in the tabernacle, under the veil of bread and wine. How about that? That's even wilder, don't you think? Now, I'm not as crazy to think, okay, that he's a statue that might look like Jesus. I'll take it one step further, okay? He looks like a wafer. See what I'm saying? I mean, it's funny, right? It's like, you know, I mean, you think I'm as crazy to think that statue's Jesus? No, it's a Eucharist, see? But this is a good way to have a sense of humor with Protestants, right? So like, wow, that's even more radical. Tell me more. See, it's a great leader. Okay. You know, that's not a defensive posture. You know, it's like, no, I'm crazier than you think. See? And they're like, okay. But then, when you have that, you know, that sort of take, believe me, I use this line all the time with people, and they're like, okay, now wait a minute. You're a reasonable person. Now, tell me what you guys believe. See? As opposed to, no, we don't really think that's Jesus, you know. Okay. All right, now, think of it like this. Do you keep pictures of your loved ones around on the fridge, on the fireplace mantle, on your computer at work? You know, why? Do you believe that's them? No. All right. But it's a reminder of your loved ones. Right? You want to have a reminder. So, you know, I always tell people, let's say they're really struggling with their work, and, you know, they sometimes have to wonder what it's all for, you know, and they're frustrated in their career or whatever. I say, look, keep a picture of your loved ones around, because when you're thinking about slacking off or not really giving it your best effort, and you look at that picture, you kind of get the motivation to maybe, you know, kick it back into gear and give a good day's effort, right? I mean, just as a practical tool. And you don't have to be Catholic to understand that, right? So, same thing with statues, right? They are representations or representations of those we venerate, like the saints, or those we adore, God. Think of it as just a picture in 3D. I don't think it's that big of a deal. However, just so you know, historically in Christendom, we have had wars, the iconoclastic period of the 6th and 7th century, where kingdoms went to war with one another over this whole question, because people thought that it was fashioning idols or graven images, and that we were somehow trying to give bodily shape and form to God, who essentially is a spiritual being. You see the debate, right? But you see, this is precisely in a way what we call the scandal of the incarnation, that Christ took flesh. Believe it or not, guys, God became man, and he walked in time and space and looked just like one of us. A man like us in all things but sin, as we say. I mean, it's sort of the scandal of our religion in the way that God would actually condescend to become one of us. So to represent him in artistic form, in a way, further galvanizes this idea that, you know, God became man. Whoa. Put that in your bum. Okay? I mean, that's pretty serious stuff. I mean, that's no small, that's something to sneeze at. I mean, that's really a serious claim. Ask a Muslim or a Jew about the idea, and they'd say that's absolutely blasphemous. God could never become man. He would never become man. He would become too much of a condescension. God would cease to be God. Because he's all other. I mean, I know God is all other, but he's also very much like us. So much so, because out of love for us, he became one of us in all things but sin. That's an amazing claim we make. And maybe it's something we take for granted because we live in a Judeo-Christian culture. But if you let go to the Holy Land, where most people are Jews or Muslims, and you talk about this idea, they're like, you all are crazy. Okay? And then we're like, you all are crazy. Okay? And it goes back and forth, right? So, you know, this idea that, you know, this whole notion of making graven images really caused a big stir in Christendom that, you know, literally, I'm not joking, thousands and thousands of people died in wars between kingdoms, one supporting the arts and what's called, you know, iconoclasm is another idea of making icons, signs or symbols of the saints versus the non-iconoclasts. So it was really quite a period in church history. All right, incense and bells. Smells and bells? Okay, now, you notice that the Catholic liturgy, especially the Mass, is very incarnational. It's very, you know, it's not just, we're not just communicating ideas, but it involves the whole person. You have to stand, you have to sit, you have to kneel. You have to be in shape to be Catholic. Okay, and this is a full body experience. You receive you receive communion. Okay, so, right, the smells is the incense. Now, in Roman times, and even before Roman times, it was very common to burn incense to the gods. We took that idea and baptized it. As if our prayers are symbolized by the smoke rising up to heaven as an oblation, an offering. Okay? The bells. Now, what about the bells? There are some who argue today that we don't need the bells today because the way the bells actually were introduced into the liturgy was simply this. The priest used to say Mass silently, right, facing the altar, and people in the back of a big church could neither hear, let alone see, what was going on. But to remind the people that it was time for the consecration, and you better pay attention, get on your knees, because the miracle's about to happen on the altar, they'd ring the bells as the priest approached that part of the Mass. Now, I'm not joking, you might think this is kind of a weird thing, but if you've ever been to a big basilica, the central part is the nave. And then you have these two side corridors parallel to the nave. And usually off of them you have side chapels, and you know, okay. And then the priest is up there in the sanctuary doing this thing. Well, the church was not just a place of worship, but it was also a place where people gathered for, you know, meetings, you know, talking about the latest gossip, probably, who knows, I mean, just people, okay? So it was not uncommon during Mass that there'd be like a little din of noise, you know, coming from the nave and the transept and whatever, people just talking, just, and then, you know, as if to say, ahem, there came the bells. You see that? And then I was like, look, this is like, I don't know what you've all been doing back there. I give the priest, like, I can't see you, I don't know what you're all doing, but shut it. Okay, this is like go time. Okay? Basically what he's saying, all right? So people say today that maybe we don't really need the bells. I kind of like the bells because even today, people still, I mean, you know, you're used to hearing the prayers and you could just be kneeling there, not paying attention. And just to salvage some last sense of what's actually going on in that sanctuary. It's nice just to hear a little reminder, okay, all right, maybe I was just distracted momentarily, okay, or maybe I'm really tired, okay, but the bells just kind of perk me up just enough that I'm actually paying attention during the consecration. Okay? So it's optional. You can use the bells, you don't have to. If you've been to parishes where they don't, you know, it's fine. It's not, they're not required. Okay? All right. Any questions about that? No? Okay. Next thing is exposition of the Blessed Sacrament and benediction. All right. Now, I want to talk about this exposition and benediction. This is a very, very, I shouldn't say it's a very ancient custom in the church. It's about 800, 900 years old. That's how old the custom of benediction exposition is. Now, what does that all mean? A good way to understand this is on any first Friday of any month, except this April, because it's Good Friday. We don't do it on Good Friday. But the other 11 Fridays of 2010, come to church between 8 in the morning and midnight. Okay, like all day to midnight. And you will see inside people praying in front of the Eucharist. But instead of being in the tabernacle hidden from our eyes, we take a large host and we put it in this glass container called a luna, because it looks like the moon. And you then you take the luna and you stick it in this instrument, this contraption called a monstrance, from the Latin word monstrare, which means to show. So what we're doing is we're almost, it's like a rewind button, like it's like a highlights film, okay, of the big game, and we're like reliving the consecration. I mean, the consecration's already happened because that host is consecrated, so it's not like we believe there's reconsecration going on, but we're returning to that high point in the Mass where the consecration occurs. And what we're doing is we're kneeling down in front of the exposed, hence exposition, Blessed Sacrament, in adoration. Okay, so that's called adoration. Now, there are chapels in our diocese and around the world, chapels of what are called perpetual adoration. That means that the Eucharist is exposed in a chapel, and there always have to be at least two people present at any given time adoring the Blessed Sacrament, 24/7, all year long. They have perpetual adoration societies, sometimes have 500 or 700 members, and they all take shifts. 4 in the morning, yep, 3 in the morning. There are people who just have that hour every week, and that's the hour they get up to go to church and pray. A church our size could technically sustain a perpetual adoration chapel because of our size. My home parish, which is half the size of this parish, has had perpetual adoration since 1981. And since 1981, my parish has churned out over 35 vocations to the priesthood of religious life. One parish. On Monday, I was with some brother priests. We were all sitting around a table. 4 out of the 8 priests at the table were from my parish. And we all knew each other growing up, and what do we all have in common? We all spent time at the Adoration Chapel. Adoration chapels produce vocations. They do. I'm living proof. Okay? And they produce conversions. Because when you're a young man and you're face-to-face with God Himself, you know, you really begin to engage the reality that, you know, Christ is literally in our midst. And Jesus is right in front of us.